when Stripe goes public, those distributions happen. That's when the good times start to roll again. Why? Well, because people will have renewed faith in the venture capital industrial complex. This venture capital industrial complex, people don't believe in it right now because they haven't seen the exits. And so when you have a couple of years of very few exits, now people start to say, well, maybe there'll never be one again. They literally become so pessimistic. The Boston Celtics will never win a title again. We traded Kevin Garnett or whatever. And then all of a sudden, hope springs eternal, and they're back in the game and they win a championship.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Vanta. Compliance and security shouldn't be a deal breaker for startups to win new business. Vanta makes it easy for companies to get a SOC 2 report fast. Twist listeners can get $1,000 off for a limited time at vanta.com/twist. Adyo, a radically new CRM for the next era of companies. Head to adyo.com/twist to get 15% off for your first year. And CLA, innovation takes balance. CLAs, CPAs, consultants, and wealth advisors can help you get from startup to where you want to end up. Get started now at claconnect.com/tech.
All right, everybody, welcome back to This Week in Startups. I'm Jason Calacanis. I am a podcaster and early stage investor here in Silicon Valley. And he's Alex Wilhelm. He is a career journalist and database analysis S110Q geek.
Yes. Yes, sir. Today, I'm also a construction and housing tech startup expert. So I spent a whole bunch of time going through dozens and dozens of community submissions for the show today. So
awesome.
I now know a whole lot about that.
Well, you know, in the area of startup land, there are some verticals which are kind of like the siren song, you know, the rocks on the beach, you know, and certainly education, health, and construction are way up there. Just, you know, it's a big prize.
Mm-hmm.
Healthcare, everybody needs it. Housing, everybody needs it. Education, everybody needs it. Like, this is 100%. The TAM is 100% of humanity. Problem is, in some places, regulation, the government will control these things, and for good reason. You want everybody to get an education. Great. Check. You don't want people building unsafe houses. You may not want your neighbors building something ridiculous next to your, you know, in your charming town. I get it. I'm not like naive here. But they have a lot of friction. There's a lot of headwinds. There's a lot of.
Yeah. Complexity that's hard to unspool, especially about who's paying in education, districts versus parents, and then in healthcare, insurance companies versus patients, and then in construction, lenders, builders, blah, 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 blah. It goes on and on and on. There's quite a lot there. But Jason, the good news is that you and I not only have Twist 500 today on the show, we also have news about StubHub's IPO getting pushed back. We have news from OpenAI about where they are in their progression towards building AGI, or what we kind of consider to be AGI. And we also have a little note that a consumer app that everyone loves is changing up its business model. So lots to get to today. Where do you want to start?
Well, you and I both love a good IPO story.
Yes, sir.
Love a good S1. And let's face it, M&A is on the rocks. A lot of people have been asking me, why is Silicon Valley, you know, maybe embracing the right a little bit? And I think the reason is, I did a guest appearance on a show called Pirate Wires. I don't know if you know the independent publication Pirate Wires.
I'm familiar with it. It's who's the guy behind
Mike Solana.
Mike Solana. I don't know Mike at all, other than that he's
like a little bit of a iconoclastic punk rock publication. It reminds me of the zine movement back in the day. You know, and so I dropped into their pod, and then I had Wired email me, and they want to know, why is Silicon Valley tilting a little bit right? And I'm like most things in life, right? People are driven by status, power, money, sex, pretty much, right? Like, these are the things that will drive humanity at space. Hey, you know, when you look at money, the big part of our ecosystem is M&A. Most companies do not IPO. Most companies shut down, and then some, a large, fat, middle of the long tail, have some level of M&A. And so when you take M&A off the table, I think that's why a lot of people are starting to lean right, hoping we can get Lena Khan out and get somebody who's pro M&A, right? Pro letting these mid-market things happen. And so when we see an IPO, man, that's DPI, that's, you know, venture capitalists getting to cash out, teams getting to cash out, or having some liquidity, as they say in the business, and then maybe be able to do some distributions so that you can invest in the next generation of startups. So these are desperately needed. StubHub's been around for well over 10 years. Come on.
Oh, it's more than 20. But on the point about why people are tilting to the right, this is not just a Silicon Valley point, although I think we've seen it because a lot of folks in tech are more chatty than other CEOs and investors. David Zaslav, the CEO of CNN's parent company, said at Sun Valley this week, I'm just going to quote from Bloomberg here, asked about the upcoming presidential election, Zaslav said it mattered less to him which party wins as long as the next president was friendly to business. Quote, we just need an opportunity for deregulation so companies can consolidate and do what we need to do to be even better. So I think the point here is people are trying to find a moral or social issue that's driving this, but I think really it's they don't want corporate tax rates to go up, and they would like to have Lena Khan not looking over their shoulder every time they want to snap up a smaller company. And I wonder if they're going to get that under Trump. We'll see. There's been an interesting shift in some of the conservative Christian right against business. So that'll be an interesting thing to watch.
Yeah, anti-business is a pretty tough one. You can take a look at Europe and where that's gotten them. You know, you can increase quality of life for the average person and then decrease competitiveness on the global marketplace. And that's really... you know, we talk about the game on the field often in our industry. The field is now the planet. We talked about work and the work arbitrage going around the planet.
Yeah,
the same is true, you know, with this jurisdiction shopping, as it were, in a business sense, not a legal sense, but in a business sense, you can pick where you put your company, you can pick where you put your venture capital dollars. And so the... you know, how to say this delicately, you know, the more you gunk things up and the more socialist you get, and you know, there's beautiful things about socialism. You know, I think it's absolutely fantastic that, you know, people get maternity paid for by the state, or paternity, you know, getting to take off when you have a baby. I'm totally fine with nursery school being covered for by my taxes, right? So some of these things seem obvious and fantastic. But man, if you go too far, you're going to lose that next IPO. You're going to lose that next great company. But let's talk about StubHub here. It was founded in 2020. You're right.
2000.
I'm sorry. Founded in 2000. This thing, though, has been a bit of a hot potato, right?
Yeah. So I was just going back through StubHub's history, prepping for today. It's been sold kind of twice. Okay. Most recently in, I think it was late 19, early 2020, when it kind of merged with a company called Viagogo. For about $4 billion. Now, the company had been rumored to be considering an IPO in 2022 at a roughly $12 billion price tag. That got put on hold for whatever reason. And now people are reporting that the company is thinking about a $16.5 billion IPO. Very exciting to your point. People love to see a big deal. However, it's been pushed back until after Labor Day. So September is now the time frame.
Got it.
And I wanted to bring this up, not because... I just wanted to bring a piece of bad news to the show, but I think we talk a lot about the exit market here, and to see a company make this choice and have it leak in the way that it did, to me, shows that people are still very much concerned about valuations and the market being, quote, choppy, if they're going to pursue an IPO. So Jason, to me, this is just indication that the caution we have seen is going to persist for the next 3 to 6 months, at least on the IPO front, which is such a bummer.
Yeah, and this is a mid-market company, right? StubHub's revenues, hundreds of millions of dollars. This isn't like a giant company. I think it's in the hundreds of millions. Yeah. And they were going to do a direct listing, if I remember correctly. And so, you know, it's and that Viagogo is another lesser-known ticketing hub. But these are all up against Ticketmaster, right? This is the 800-pound gorilla. And so, yeah, and things get pushed back. It could be summer doldrums, but the market keeps hitting records. You know, this is one of the topics we did on All In this week as well was just macro.
Yeah.
I mean, this is one of the most peculiar moments in time because you have so many people feeling like the economy's bad, even though record low unemployment, real wages rate rising, and inflation getting really tampered down. We had a great inflation print this week, and cuts are coming. Apparently, that's 80-90% chance of a cut in the fall, or 90+ chance of a rate cut in the fall. So in the stock market hitting all-time highs over and over again. So people keep making excuses of why this economy's bad or good. Really does feel like consumers, you know, maybe feel it when they go to grocery stores, and it's an emotional thing. Like it's pretty palatable when your Happy Meal costs $12 versus six or seven, right? And maybe when you have a variable interest mortgage or a variable interest loan payment. So I do understand that there's a group of people who feel this very acutely. I don't want to be like clueless.
Well, let's be a little mean about it. I mean, so I've always been very confused why gas prices are such a big deal, because it's never been a huge chunk of my household expenses. And then it was explained to me that people tend to be a bit more over-levered on their car purchases than you and I might expect them to be. Longer loan times, higher costs. Cars are expensive these days. And so people often end up with a car they can barely afford. And then gas prices go up, and suddenly just running that vehicle makes their entire household budget stretch. And that's why those are so directly linked to like consumer happiness polls and such. And so when we think about how the economy is doing, I mean, our equity holdings have appreciated, but if you don't have any, how much do you care that today the Dow Jones Industrial Average did hit a new all-time intraday high? You and I are like, sweet, free money. But, you know, so to me, I get both sides of this picture, but I don't see a reason why strong companies can't put on their big boy pants and go public.
Absolutely. Do a big boy press conference, do a big boy IPO. Let's go.
Just do it. I mean, do you think that it's going to be that much better in a couple of months? There might be a rate cut, but as you pointed out to me on Twitter yesterday, the day before, priced in. It's already priced in.
It's all priced in. It's always been priced in. It always will be priced in. There are really smart people who operate in the global casino known as the market. So this idea that nothing is going to be, it's not priced in is crazy. Ticketmaster is owned by Live Nation, as most people know. That's got a $22 billion market cap. And so, you know, I think this is actually, I might want to put a J trade on for this. We'll have to do a deep dive, you and I, when we get closer to the IPO, and we'll do that since that's your specialty. Listen, a strong sales team can make all the difference for a B2B startup. But if you're going to hire sharks, you need to let them hunt, and you can't slow them down with compliance hurdles like SOC 2. What is SOC 2? Well, any company that stores customer data in the cloud needs to be SOC 2 compliant. If you don't have your SOC 2 tight, your sales team can't close major deals. It's that simple. But thankfully, Vanta makes it really easy to get and renew your SOC 2 compliance. On average, Vanta customers are compliant in just 2 to 4 weeks. Without Vanta, it takes 3 to 5 months. Vanta can save you hundreds of hours of work and up to 85% on compliance costs. And Vanta does more than just SOC 2. They also automate up to 90% compliance for GDPR, HIPAA, and more. So here's your call to action. Stop slowing your sales team down and use Vanta. Get $1,000 off at vanta.com/twist. That's vanta.com/twist for $1,000 off your SOC 2. The reason I really like these kind of companies is because people want experiences. I think you talked a little bit about the stretching that people do, buying a home, buying a car. I think generationally that stopped with my generation, Gen Xers. We started to say like, you know, I really want that BMW, but, you know, get the 325i, but maybe I should go for the 520, you know, like, and you kind of had this like little competition going with your friends and your peer group.
Yeah.
Oh, I got a 3-bedroom apartment. Like I remember I knew somebody who had like a 3-bedroom and there was like one person. I'm like, why do you have a 3-bedroom? He's like, oh, what's a guest room? And this is Manhattan. Oh, one's my guest room, oh my one's gosh. My office, and you know, then I have my bedroom, and I'm like, but it's $1,200 per room. That's $4,000 in the 90s, right. And I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. But it's nepo baby, whatever, you know. And that is, I think, with each subsequent generation, they look at home ownership and say, you know, I can't hit that. Therefore, I'm never going to own a home because they're too expensive. There's too few of them, but I can own experiences of my time. And yes. I look at my parents working really hard, boomers, and then, you know, people who have Gen X parents, they're working hard. They're 50 years old, they're 60 years old, they're 70 years old. They're still working hard. And like now they're going to start going on vacation when they're 68 years old. Like, I'll just take the vacations now and I'll do the reverse. I'll, you know, F around.
There you go.
When I'm younger, and then I'll, you know, work harder when I'm older. And so there's just a little bit of that going on. But I love anything that's experience-based. I like the hotels. I like the cruises. I like, you know, airlines, you know, tickets. People want to do this. And it's amazing they're willing to spend for it. These summer concerts, Taylor Swift.
Dude, they're so expensive.
So expensive.
And
I'm independently post money. And I looked at the Taylor Swift stuff. I was going to like, oh, maybe I'll take my kid. I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. $3,000 a ticket to go to a concert? That's it's a 2-hour concert, but we're talking about, I don't know what that is, $10 a minute. I started doing the math on it. I'm like, this is not making sense.
You should go to heavy metal shows. They're like $8 and they're like 4 hours long. It's super cost efficient.
So yeah, I actually always did this entertainment per hour. And I always thought about what had the most entertainment value per hour. What do you think has the most entertainment, highest entertainment value, lowest cost per hour?
Oh, that's easy. You go to your local grocery store, you get a 6-pack of fizzy water or beer, whatever your friends drink. You get some chips and some, like maybe some little carrots and some dip. And then you put your favorite, like 6 people around in your living room, put on some music and just hang out. Like that, if you have the right people, that is the single most efficient way to have fun. It works every time.
$5 an hour. Boom.
Well, poker, right? I mean,
poker's another good one. Yeah. I mean, if you're playing low stakes, you could play a 6-hour session. Everybody throws in $100. So essentially it's free because the money is just moving around the table and getting distributed. Yes. And you got to drink and eat food anyway. So that's sort of baked in. Yeah, that is actually activities with your friends would be a great one. Absolutely.
But I'm curious, what were you thinking about?
Video games on a media basis. If you think about packaged media, a movie, going to the movies winds up being like $20 a person with parking or whatever. Mm-hmm. 2 hours, $10 an hour. You go to a theme park, $100. You stay for 10 hours, $10 an hour. Mm-hmm. And as I went through this, you know, when I used to think about this when I was a journalist, I was always like, it always seems to be working out to the minimum wage, plus or minus, like maybe minimum wage times two. And I think that there's something to this where, like, if you are charging people for entertainment, they're willing to pay. Like, I worked 2 days this week and I spent it on one day of entertainment. You go to a sports game, right? I go to sports on the weekend. I go to a Yankee game, $50 a ticket. I go to a basketball game, $150 a ticket. You know, it's 3 or 4 hours of entertainment. That's pretty expensive, $25-$35 an hour. But, you know, if you make that an hour, you kind of hash it out, right? So there you have it.
Yeah, no, I'm totally on that. And I think video games.
Video games were the one I was thinking. If you hit a video game that you love, mm-hmm. like Age of Empires, I've played a couple of thousand hours of Age of Empires. It's kind of like chess to me. And it costs $50. So now, you know, if you play 50 hours, you're at $1, 500 hours, 10 cents. Mm-hmm. You pay for 5,000 hours, you're at a penny an hour. It's essentially free. So I think video games also very, very cost efficient.
You should see the number of games I have in my Steam library that I haven't even actually installed yet, that I've just bought to warehouse, like old Google employees. But I'm totally with you on that. The thing about, I think, concerts that I'm very excited about, just to put a pin in this, is that people are still going. I know music has always been a tough business and inflation has changed the cost of touring and such, but every time a band that I love goes on tour, they post pictures from their shows and it's packed. And I think that it's good that humans are still going out and doing that, even in this very modern digital Instagram-y kind of era. So that's what's encouraging.
Also, I think it's a reaction to just how pernicious and addicting social media is. And I see this with young kids. You know, I have a 14-year-old, I have 2 8-year-olds, and they have peers. And so we'll host kids over the house or whatever. And man, there's the television and streaming services, mm-hmm. YouTube on iPads, video games, social media. We don't allow social media, but a lot of other parents do. And like, I just remember one time we were at the ski house and they, you know, had a sleepover or whatever. And one of the kids' friends came over, happened to be into like social media. They were allowed. And this kid was curled up in a ball going, scrolling up. And I just like, this is not a childhood, you know? And I was like, I talked to this parent about it, you know, no judgments. I understand, like, you know, it's hard to enforce these things, but you know, here we are at a ski mountain. There's 3 feet of snow outside. There's a heated pool at the lodge. They could go in a game room there with like pool and stuff. there's a pool and there's pool. And I'm like, and there's sleds. And I'm like, in our childhood, we didn't have internet. We didn't have distractions. You know, we may have had a video game console. And that was something that was a bit of an allure. And I just basically tell them, like, listen, no screens until the sun goes down.
Yeah.
And you can use screens if you had an active day on the mountain. And you know what? Everybody bought into that. And I think in some ways, kids want that. And it really was disturbing during this pandemic to see the psychological negative effects. And I just had John Haidt on the All In interview show that we tested. Mm-hmm. And his book is really good about this anxious generation. They need to get out there. They need to be allowed to grow. There's a really cool organization called Let Grow. You can Google it. And it's just about getting kids off screens and getting them in the real world, building their confidence, let them play tag, let somebody lose at tag, let there be a wrestling match where somebody gets hurt, and then let them sort it out themselves without parental
intervention. That's the thing. Everyone talks about how the kids are soft, but then, you know, have you seen parents in the wild? You can see why they get it, because have you heard of snowplow parenting?
No.
So not I know helicopter parenting. Snowplow parenting is when the parent goes in front of the child and clears everything out of the way for them.
It is really, I learned the language. Language is so important. You and I, as wordsmiths and word salads, you know, really care about this. And when you have kids, super important. So when they come to you with their problem, I say, oh, what's your plan? Mm. What's your strategy? And they're like, what's my strategy? I'm like, yeah, you got enough. With your sibling, or you and your friend can't decide something, and so what's your strategy? And they'll be like, well, they want to, you know, go in the pool and I want to watch a movie, so I think, well, we'll do the pool then the movie, because that makes sense, and we'll just take a shower in between. And I'm like, okay, great. Sounds like you have a good plan, as opposed to getting in the, you know, the rig and then blowing the snow and clearing a path for them.
Now, you guys are going to sit down and mediate this right now, and I'm going to be the referee. It's like, learn, because otherwise life is just bad for you. Like, you're not helping your kids, you're making them.
Absolutely not. Learned helplessness is it's really strange. Like, there are some kids, I see them, you know, at the schools and the functions, who have this learned helplessness. And they just, anytime there's a problem, they just cannot solve it. They give up. No resiliency, constantly going to their parents. And, you know, this leads them to get into the real world and they're not prepared to work at a job.
They're not prepared for anything. Well, I mean, look, you and I could talk about parenting until the cows come home.
Startups and small businesses, listen up. You want a CRM that neatly organizes all your customer data so that you can avoid missed opportunities and you can deliver a personalized service. Rigid CRMs can adapt to your fast-growing needs, and that's where Atio comes in. ATTIO delivers the goods. It's a custom CRM that's flexible and deeply intuitive. Atio is built for the modern company, headed into the next era of businesses. It connects your data sources, adjusts easily to your specific setup, and suits any business approach, whether it's self-serve or sales-driven. Atio automatically enriches all your contacts. Think about that. You might be missing a first name, a last name, an email, an address, all of that stuff. It's going to sync your emails and calendars. It's going to enrich those contacts, and it's going to give you powerful reports. It's also going to let you quickly build Zapier-style automations, if this, then that type of automations. The next generation deserves more than a one-size-fits-all CRM. Join 11 Labs, Replicate, Modal, and more, and get ready to scale your startup to the next level. Head to atio.com/twist, and you'll get 15% off your first year. That's atio.com/twist.
I want to loop back to inflation, though, actually, because there's some very interesting stuff. And then I want to work into venture capital numbers, because I think we can paint a positive picture for all the founders out there and give them a little bit of good news. So we just learned that the consumer inflation rate has cooled in June. We actually saw a decline at one point and a 3% gain year over year, better than expectations. Now, today, wholesale prices, the PPI, this is the consumer inflation chart BLS, showing how far it's come down. And the last tick is actually the best one. So that's very encouraging. And then more recently, we saw the producer price index, or the PPI, rise by 2.2% in June, a little bit higher than expected, but not that bad. And I think the overall inflation picture is cooling. And as you said earlier, we're expecting a rate cut. Here's my question for you. Knowing all of that, the rate cut's coming, maybe even two this year, we'll see. When does the good vibes begin to trickle down to the VCs and then trickle down to the startups? Because rates have been high, money's been expensive, valuations have been down. Sure. When does it begin to flip now that the good news is coming?
So when the exits occur, bringing up the StubHub thing, whoever the investors are, now that's a really old company, but, you know, let's say another company like Stripe. When Stripe goes public, those distributions happen. That's when the good times start to roll again. Why? Well, because people will have renewed faith in the venture capital industrial complex. This venture capital industrial complex, people don't believe in it right now because they haven't seen the exits. And so when you have a couple of years of very few exits, now people start to say, well, maybe there'll never be one again. They literally become so pessimistic. The Boston Celtics will never win a title again. We traded Kevin Garnett or whatever. And then all of a sudden, hope springs eternal, and they're back in the game and they win a championship. So, you know, the psychology of humans is very strange. You know, you could see the Airbnb, Coinbase, and Uber IPOs. And, you know, that wasn't too long ago, what, 5 years ago. And then people all of a sudden, it's 5 years later, like, it's, you know, the industry's over. It's over. It's never going to happen again. And it's like, are you guys watching what happened with NVIDIA? Are you watching what's happening with Tesla? Are you watching what's happening with Facebook and Meta going from $91 a share to $500 a share in 18 months? Like, wake up, folks. Like, these are, the world can still change. Companies can still have IPOs and there can be exits. So there's just a little malaise. And once that gets lifted, when people feel rich, they behave differently. When they feel optimistic, they behave differently. So the reason why people were willing to spend $250,000 on a JPEG was because they felt rich.
It was a link to a JPEG. It wasn't the JPEG itself.
Sure. Critically. The hash of the JPEG.
Sorry.
But it, yes. This was the craziest moment. Like, I'm like, okay, listen, I'm super like open to new innovations, but I'm sorry, what? You're buying, you know, immutable JPEGs and imaginary money. The whole crypto, frenzy was because people believed everything went up and to the right and stonks go up. That was kind of, you know, Dave Portnoy's kind of joke when he was doing his day trading. It was like, stocks go up. That's why we buy stocks, because they go up. And he was, it's kind of like his, like, you know, pizza reviews. Everybody knows the rule, one bite, and then he takes four bites. Like, he's obviously joking with you. Stocks can go down as well. And so you have moments of irrational pessimism we've been in for the last couple of years, irrational optimism during crypto and stocks and GameStop and et cetera. So I think we're probably over-indexing on pessimistic. That's why so many venture firms are going out of business. That's why,
yeah,
you know, you're seeing this consolidation, companies go out of business. But it's, I've learned over these last three boom-bust cycles, because now I'm old and you're getting old too.
I know.
As I pointed out on a show recently.
You've lived through too. There's now a theme to the show.
There's now a theme. We're getting old.
Jason tells Alex he's also old. That's
also, you know, old.
I'll put
also
that on the show notes.
I mean, 18 years younger, but still old. People were really taken back by my, I would give up every penny in order to.
Yeah.
That kind of caught, like, people were like off guard. They're like, what? I'm like, yeah, 18 years back. Yeah.
The difference is how much people put someone's success to luck versus work. Because if you can go back and you don't have the same luck, some people might think that there's then no hope for a similar rebuild. Oh. But you're saying, if I get 18 years back, what would I pay per minute, per hour,
per year
of your time, per year?
Incredible. So long story short, to your original question, it's going to get better. And the lunacy will come back when people feel rich again.
Yeah.
People are, because of the stock market, feeling pretty good, but there's kind of like, when's this rug going to get pulled out? When's the correction coming? It feels a little too good.
Yes.
The inflation feels like, okay, it's trending, but there's still this fear like it's going to come back.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a low grade anxiety in the markets and a high grade anxiety in Silicon Valley about venture. You kind of layer these things on. And I was just talking to a friend who had some stomach problems. And I'm like, are you feeling existential angst? They're like, maybe I am. I'm like, okay, that manifests in the stomach. Like, you're hurt an ulcer? Like, ulcers? Ulcer. Like,
yeah.
Ulcers. Like, this is like a known thing. Like, and so we're going to see these two things get worked out over the next year, I think, or very, very quickly, actually, I think. It could be by the end of this year. See a couple of IPOs, see a couple of rate cuts. People start feeling really good about it. Now, if inflation comes back with a 3-4 print instead of a 3-0 print, that could put a big dampening on it. Yeah. So
there's a lot of what has inflation done in its most recent tick, and then we all kind of forecast off of that. The rate cuts will happen when the rate cuts happen. Probably one this year, maybe two. Now, the thing that I've been kind of looking for are green shoots in the world of venture, because I also agree that things have been a little bit too pessimistic for too long. And so I pulled some data, but I want to start with the bad news and then tell you the good news. So let's talk about what happened in Asia on the venture capital side in the second quarter. Crunchbase has some new data out that I pulled for us. Quoting from Crunchbase News, Asia suffered its worst quarter for venture funding since the final quarter of 2015, with Asia-based startups raising only $14.6 billion, off 24% from the first quarter and 32% from last year. This is, of course, Jason, driven by China, which has always been the biggest player in Asian venture capital. And VCs in that country only put $6.9 billion to work in the first quarter. That was off 46% from Q1 and a third off from Q2 of last year. Just brutal, brutal numbers. And I don't think either one of us are surprised by them, given some high-flying Indian startups struggling and, of course, China's authoritarian tilt, if you will, towards business in the last couple of years. Now, that's the bad news. There's good news for founders in Europe. And so I was so glad you teed up the European comment earlier on, because we have something that's better than expected. So pulling from Deal Room data. So from the Deal Room presentation, this is the historical amount of venture capital disbursed inside of Europe. And in the second quarter, it was up 14% compared to Q1 and 12% year on year. So Jason, tell me why you now must eat all of your words about European regulation, because we have seen some gains.
I mean, they're modest gains, let's be clear. But, you know, if you were to normalize the line and take out the ZERP era, it would look pretty anemic, right? It would look not flat, but it would look slow. So, you know, like everything else in Europe, it's just slow growth. Yeah.
All right. Well, tell me what you really think.
Almost. I mean, it's almost slow by design, right? If you want to create regulations that protect workers, protect the environment, you know, and, you know, that's your choice as a society to do that, it will just take away the speed at which things get done, right? We're seeing it here in the United States with regulation as well, right? So things can get slowed down. You want to build a factory, can't do it in California, can do it in Texas, you know, et cetera. So the Asia thing is the most interesting to me, because India, of course, is included in that data or not. Because I know some people, when they do Asia, they'll leave India out because it's so big now.
So that is included. And if you want the India numbers, $3.4 billion in second quarter funding, 27% up from Q1, but 9% down year over year. So kind of mixed picture there.
Yeah, India is very, venture data, because of big deals, like we talked about with the XAI deal, can get skewed, right? A big deal can drop in one quarter. So you got to look year over year and look at a 10-year trend. I do think people are looking for where to deploy money. And China was a really great place to deploy money for a couple decades. Now with isolationism, you know, both chosen and imposed, you know, the Chinese have chosen to isolate a bit, and it's being imposed upon them because we have FISA, you know, when you're foreign investment in some of these regions, they're slowing you down. Sequoia had to deal with this. Anybody investing in chips has had to deal with this. And you'll get a little knock on the door like, hey, you're investing in something over there. Let's talk about, because if you do invest in China, you're essentially investing in the Chinese government. Just by default, right? Because they own and they're on the boards of these companies, and DD and TikTok, it's all their companies at the end of the day, is the way it works in those ecosystems. So, it's China's quite a story in terms of just a lack of investment there. We talked about that before. And India's, I know that a lot of American investors and investors in MENA, the Middle East, North African region, are kind of looking at it and saying, population growth, and there's a middle class that's emerging. And this is when you want to make money as a capital allocator, you're looking for trends that are so pronounced that they will, create really big waves you can surf.
Yeah.
India's population is growing. China's is contracting, and Japan's is contracting. Okay. There's one really big trend you could ride. They've also started these $10, that maybe they cost $15 Android phones. There's a specific company that's selling $15 Android phones. And then the service is $3 or $4 a month. I forgot the name of it, but it's become like a huge trend in India. This one of the richest people in India has been doing this. It's a very bold move to just be like, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to just flood the country with cheap Android phones. And it worked.
Jio. This is Reliance, the Reliance umbrella of companies. Jio is their low-cost mobile provider. Very big company. And I believe that a bunch of American tech companies bought a small stake in it because they wanted to make sure they had access to the Indian consumer. I think
Facebook might be the one who has a big partnership with them. And they made this Facebook Lite, like a lower footprint app that could work on like, you know, what are essentially 3 or 4 year old Android level phones. So I think they've got a couple of 100 million people. And so you got people who are living in essentially poverty, but have an Android phone now. It's very interesting on a science fiction societal basis. This probably hasn't happened in a long time, but to be living, you know, under the poverty line on a dollar a day, whatever those statistics are, maybe, you know, running water shared, maybe, you know, electricity being inconsistent
or
not having it in your home, whatever it is. And then you have a smartphone with broadband, with access to ChatGPT and Wikipedia and YouTube. Like, this is kind of crazy. And where did this happen last? It happened in China.
Yeah.
How did it happen in China? Everybody started to work in factories, and they worked in factories in order to build the smartphones. So this is all like the smartphone revolution has had such a profound impact on so many different dimensions. That Black Mirror has had a massive, massive impact. That's very different than, I think we'll look back historically, like on the introduction of the smartphone specifically, in a way, like we look at steam engines, airplanes, factories, other things, writing.
Oh, yeah. Personal computing, the internet, and then mobile internet connectivity computing is like those are the three big epics we've seen thus far. And what's interesting about your point about smartphone manufacturing being actually a way that people rose from, let's call it agricultural rural poverty, to a rising working class towards the middle class in a more industrialized society in China was through often smartphone construction. Where is that moving now, Jason? Well, people are moving factories out of China into Vietnam and into India.
Yeah.
I mean, Foxconn's doing a big push into India.
Yeah, they're making iPhone 14s, I think, and maybe even 15s now in India. So all of this means India is like a really interesting market. All right, everybody, welcome back to the program. Stephen Estes is with us again. He's a principal at CLA. They're a professional services provider. They specialize in CPA, tax consulting, and wealth advisory. His areas of expertise lie in VC-backed startups, VC funds, high-growth startups with complex tax issues in multi-state and international filings. Welcome back to the program, Stephen.
Hey, thanks, Jason. Appreciate it.
When you look at these growth periods, right, when startups start rapidly growing, how do they screw it up?
First and foremost, the sales tax. There was a big shakeup in that about 4 years ago. It kind of opened the floodgates to states really being able to force small companies to collect and remit sales tax in a lot of different states. When we had the pandemic hit and the rise of remote work, that really intensified that, as having employees in various states creates the requirement to collect and remit to sales and customers in that state. So that was huge. And then secondly, I think really just like how to handle the issuance of equity to key employees. It amazes me that founders don't know more about various restricted stock awards and stock option plans that are out there. Safes have been a godsend when it comes to keeping 409A values low for early stage companies, but a lot of founders don't have a clue when it comes to how like a priced round can negatively impact your ability to bring on those critical hires, because it really massively increases the tax liabilities that come with the receipt of equity in those companies.
All right. You need a trusted advisor, taxes, accounting. You don't want to play games with this stuff. Get it right. Get a great partner like CLA. Go to claconnect.com/tech and let them know your boy J. Cal sent you. Once again, claconnect.com/tech. I also noticed a lot of Indian entrepreneurs when I was in the Middle East, when I was in Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Saudi, Doha. A lot of them are moving there. Now, that's really interesting bedfellows.
That is very interesting. Because
why?
Well, so I have a... If, Yeah, you, yeah, sorry, you tell me.
No, no, you tell me. Why?
Well, I realized I was about to get in trouble. So I was backpedaling away from my own comment like a prodded crawdad.
Yeah. If we pull up flights from Dubai to Mumbai.
Oh my gosh, that's free.
Yeah. So, you know, round trip, $229, 3 hour flight. This is Mumbai to Dubai. 3 hour flight. You know, this is like going from New York to Miami, right? It's not quite Los Angeles to San Francisco, but
yeah,
it's a hop skip. It's a hop skip. And I don't know if other cities are closer, but if I were to do, I think Saudi, yeah, 4 hour nonstop from Riyadh to Mumbai. And I think there are other cities that are closer. You know, there's some cities that are like an hour. So you start looking at that. There are like states that are next to each other. Okay, now let's peel back one more time. The MENA region is very small countries. Saudi's big, 30, 40 million people. UAE's a couple million people. Qatar. Doha is a city. Qatar is like, I think, 1.5 million people and maybe 400,000 nationals. The number of nationals in these countries is very small. In fact, Saudi is a very large country. People don't realize that compared to the others. India is giant, billion people. So you got a billion people here. You got 2 million people over here. When they need help in those countries to build something, Pakistani, Indian, Sri Lankan, construction workers, domestic staff, waiters, it's like everywhere. And then also Thai, Singapore, they also can go to those regions. So then you have entrepreneurs happening. Well, if you're an entrepreneur in India and you can't raise funding, and then you have nationals who have large wealth. When I was there, I spoke to a group of like 30 angel investors, and they hosted a lunchroom with 30 family/angel investors. And they had all read my book, because there's really only one book on angel investing. So I'm like one of one. But they had all read the book, and they were all pursuing techniques in angel investing. So this is the first decade that they're doing it. And they're looking at markets, and they're like, yeah, it's nice to launch something, Karim, you know, the Uber of the region. Yeah, the Middle East. Like, okay, yeah, those things are going to happen, but there's a billion people over there. Maybe we should build some stuff over there. It's only 3 hours away. So it's the same way Masayoshi-san in Japan was like, you know, okay, the Japanese market's great, but we could also go to Vietnam, Singapore, Korea, and let's take this, you know, line company, SoftBank, whatever. Let's try to find other regions that we can go build businesses in. So it's pretty interesting.
I want to just double click on one thing before we move on and talk about OpenAI. How bullish are investors on India today in the venture capital community? And how does that compare to 12 or 18 months ago? I want to understand that what's changed.
Very interested. They're very interested because it's a democracy. It's not a high functioning democracy. It's like one of these democracies that's kind of, you know, I don't want to say teetering, but it's a democracy. But if you were to look at the democratic index, they would put it, you know, as like a tier down or two tiers down. So it is a democracy. You could feel relatively safe making a bet in India or in Dubai or Abu Dhabi. And then people would feel less secure making a bet, you know, in Russia, obviously. If you've read Red Notice, your lawyer will be murdered.
Like, that book, by the way.
Incredible.
Incredible.
I mean, it just, if you want an incredible book to read this summer or listen to, the audiobook's fantastic as well. Go for it. And so, you know, I think that's what's happened in China. You know, if you own shares in Alibaba, you know, do you trust what's going on there? They do financial manipulation of their currency. They're on the boards of these companies. They have data agreements with these companies. And of course, like, could the account, I mean, with this whole real estate thing that was going on in China, like the government, we're in a democracy where investigative journalists have to figure out and traders and shorters have to figure out the fraud in the United States, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we have this like weird antibodies here. Strut selling, you know? All the Hindenburg research, like, they serve a really good purpose to find fraud. I love these guys.
Yeah, me too. I love reading the reports.
We have whistleblowers.
Yes.
Another incredible tradition. And people forget here, a whistleblower gets paid half of the money that they get recovered. you can make $100 million right now going and, you know, finding the next Madoff. This is a big prize for you. Hindenburg gets a big prize. You short the stock, goes down, you make all your money, secure your bag, you get out. And of course, we have journalists who win awards and prizes and status.
That's and the worst. Like, you can have $1 bajillion. You can have $1 bajillion or a small plastic statue and a crappy dinner at a round table.
But if you're elite, if you're a wordsmith like us, to break the story of, you know, of the Catholic Church at the Boston Globe in your, you know, whatever, second tier city, supposedly, and you break a story like that, come on. I mean, that's as good as it gets. You could be really, I mean, for your entire life, you have that. If you're John Carreyrou and you expose Theranos, I mean, the joy that would come from that is just, for certain people, including myself.
Yes, I was just laughing.
It's like winning the World Series of Poker.
That does come with a couple of dollars, though, as well as the pride elements of it. By the way, when are we going to go do the main event together?
Oh, absolutely next year, for sure. And I will stake you. You're officially staked.
You can buy half my action. But
okay, I'll buy half your action.
I realized that it was going on, I think, right now, and I wasn't there, and I need a buddy to go with.
Next summer, we'll go for 2 weeks. And we'll do interviews there. We'll do the show for 2 weeks. We'll absolutely book that. I'll buy you into a bunch of stuff. I'll play for charity. You pay for your kids' charity for college education. And we will have a blast. Yeah. We'll do some meetups. We'll interview people because there's a lot of founders there. It'd be great.
There's
what a great
there.
Idea.
I really think we need to take a twist on the road at some point in time. But just for the sake of time, let's talk about OpenAI. So the big news this week is that OpenAI had an internal meeting and they sat everyone down and said, hey, here's how we're thinking about the world and here's where we are. So in OpenAI's perspective, there are five levels of artificial intelligence. The first one we're all familiar with, chatbots. We've all used them. Easy. Number two, level two, is reasoners. So essentially things that can think as well as humans. Level three is agents, essentially AI that can do stuff.
And then about
four, I talked about that. Level four is innovators, essentially AI that can help us come up with new ideas. I like that. And then level five in OpenAI's view is organizational AI or AI that can do the work of a team. Now, the thing is, and why this is so interesting to me is OpenAI thinks they're at level one and they're nearly at level two. But agents in their conception are level three. But right now we're seeing venture capitalists and founders fund and build a lot of agentic AI startups like Sierra with Brett Taylor.
Of course.
Yeah. And so the thing that I'm trying to sort out here is who's right? Because OpenAI is saying, we're not there. Even we're not there yet. And founders are saying, we're there, we're doing this. And so there's an interesting tension between who's actually correct about about agents in an AI context. I'm fascinated by this.
It's great to make a list like this and start thinking about it. This is like iRobot territory. Asimov, I haven't read his stuff, but I've seen the movies based on his stuff. So we're sort of getting into rules of robotics here, rules of being sentient, Blade Runner territory. Agents are easily available today. They're just locked down. So, you know, Apple does not let you have AI open apps up and do things. AI is capable of that today. It's that the cost of running an agent that then went awry, who's responsible for it is problematic. So if I were to say to Gemini or ChatGPT-4, I need a flight to Dubai, book me a flight based on my criteria, and it went and booked me something, and it was like, I don't know, there's a $27,000 ticket because it's the last one available, and it knows that I like to fly this certain time, but the two flights on either side of it are $2,700. That's a big mistake to make, right? Or, hey, order me sushi. The chef cooks all the sushi. They bring it. And they gave you the sushi you don't like and you send it back. So anyway, it's kind of reminds me of the Amazon Alexa conundrum where nobody really trusted Alexa to say, hey, Alexa, buy me coffee. What if it buys the wrong beans? Like people are very particular about their coffee. So agents have worked for some time. They could work today. It's that the cost is a human one. And the cost of a mistake is just really challenging. And who bears the cost of the mistake? So I would argue reasoning, they're like 30% of the way there, and then I think with agents, we're probably 50, 60, 70% of the way there. It really is that trust piece. I do think they have the order of the last two incorrect. I think their like obsession with organizations is like kind of silly, because once you have five agents doing things, that's kind of an organization. I think the innovation is the key. And you have to really define that. I would say to be able to solve problems humans have yet to solve, to be able to solve problems humans can't solve. These are really two different things. So it might be that AI figures out, hey, where are, you know, where are these endangered species by looking at satellite images? And it's just because it's just like such a big project, humans haven't gotten to it. Or like studying these folding of proteins and finding some new thing. It's really kind of like brute force. Like a human can do it, but AI can do it 1,000 times faster. Then there's make a unique novel discovery in the world. How does dark matter work? What happened before the Big Bang? You know, that's the kind of stuff where if it could solve conundrums that we don't understand, solve math equations that are not solved by humans yet, those are two different levels of unique innovation in the world. And I think there's like soft and there's hard. And I think that's the two levels. When we see it solve something hard, that's when it's going to get really weird, like really weird. That's like the aliens coming to your planet and being like, you know what? You guys have been dealing with cancer. Oh, we solved that 300 years ago. Here's the formula. And they just hand you like a thumb drive or like they just tap you on the nose and it's in your brain. And you're like, oh, yeah, we wouldn't have gotten to that for another 300 years because our brains aren't big enough. So that's the one I think is like, whoa, that's going to change the species forever. This kind of stuff's going to be just a lot of incremental speed and velocity to solving problems in the world. But the fact that they're thinking like this speaks to their noble origin of wanting to make this technology accessible to everybody for free and do it in a thoughtful, open way.
I agree with that.
Yeah. That was kind of the ethos that I think, you know, got people like Elon to write 8-figure checks into this nonprofit. But now to take that entire ethos and say commercial, IPO, secondary offerings, that's where I think there's an ethical problem. I think that's why people are now, I mean, I don't know if you've seen the pylon on Sam Altman, who we had on All In, but there's basically this, I mean, I don't want to speak, I like Sam and I'm friendly with him, so I don't want to say anything negative about him, but basically people are saying outwardly, you cannot trust this person. Like Ari Emanuel said it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I haven't seen this in my career where a whole group of people have come out and said, this person is not to be trusted. Can you think of any time that's happened in business where people, everybody's like in unison, a bunch of people are just like, don't trust this person?
Well, there have been certain examples. I mean, you mentioned Madoff earlier. I think after he got exposed, that was the case. I think
Ponzi scheme in history, but a person who has not been convicted of a Ponzi scheme.
Trump, famous for not paying his bills.
Sure. Okay, sure.
Not to bring politics into this, but that was the first example that came to mind, having read his history in Atlantic City and so forth.
Yeah. Trump University. Yeah. He's been a low level, you know, bending hustler. The rules, grifter, hustler guy. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So anyway. I just think this is like this is what really is at stake with AI is whoever gets to, you know, when you go down that list, who gets there first matters.
I think that's definitely the case. But my question is, will it be like what we've seen so far? Because one thing that's blown my mind is, ChatGPT comes out, everyone goes, holy crap, this is amazing. Look at this thing. Look at the things we can do with it. Look what it can unlock for us. And then the market quickly caught up in LLM potential. Like, I mean, Llama, Claude, Gemini. I mean, there's a lot of models out there that are pretty good and all progressing pretty quickly. So when you say who gets there first, I want to know how close is the second place to catching up? Because if the answer is 20 minutes, it's probably less valuable than if it's 20 years. So that's one thing that I just don't know if everyone can keep progressing at the same rate, more or less, or if people are going to start to pull ahead with better talent, more compute, or whatever it is that is the differentiating factor. But at least according to OpenAI, we are early on all things AI. I mean, the fact that they're level 1.5 out of 5 is either encouraging or depressing. I don't know which one I favor more.
2 out of 5. I put them at 2 out of 5. If you know, were to prorate, you know, they're 30% on agents.
I see.
30% on this, 10% on the other two. I kind of give them a little bit more, but the product's gotten, I feel like the product is, if it was a, if this product was a human being,
yes,
I feel like it's growing 10 years every year or more in terms of experience. Cause
yeah,
you know, like it didn't feel like a child. It felt like a college student for a little while, like a high school college student. Like it's naive, but it can answer the questions on the standardized test. And now I feel like it's a young, it's an adult. Like it's a researcher who's 30 years old working at McKinsey or something, or a 28-year-old working, you know, at the corporate headquarters of Walmart or something. Like you can ask it to do a task that's multi-pronged and it will do it like a research. I put it like as a researcher. It's like a somewhere between a researcher and an analyst today.
Yeah. One thing I want to get to, not today, we don't have time, but I want to go back and interrogate the who's going to win, SaaS plus AI or software that's rebuilt from the ground up to be AI first. You talked about this with Sarah Tavel on an interview back in September that I was going through. And I'm really curious to see how much of software needs to be rebuilt to take advantage of all the stuff that we're discussing today, because if it's growing by 10 years every year, AI, eventually everything else is going to look pretty silly and dated.
Mm.
Yeah.
I agree. And it's just as a product, it has been getting better and better. I've been talking about some like complex examples. I've been giving ChatGPT 4.0 and Claude
3.5.
Yeah, but it's got a name.
Sonnet?
Is it Sonnet? Yeah, it might be Sonnet. Yeah. And it's pretty darn impressive. I think we're at the researcher phase. And man, so what it means to me is you just for every, I think, one researcher is two researchers today using ChatGPT.
Yeah. Oh, this one goes back to your point about static employee bases and rising revenues at companies for the next 3 to 5 years as people have more, I don't know, let's just call it overall leverage on their time using more technology. Yeah, this is not the bicycle for the mind. This is the moped up to the Ducati of the mind. And we'll see when we get to the F1 car of the mind.
It's almost like I think you would have almost unlimited researchers at some point. And then you're just like the value of research becomes kind of commodified. It's almost like having accountants back in the day or a typing pool. Like you had a photocopy and a document storage and a typing pool and a research department, and you had an accounting department, and you had data entry people. Like all that stuff kind of got abstracted away by technology. And I do feel like research and analysis, like if you, I don't like to short companies, but McKinsey, Boston Consulting Group, like all those consultants, like what they're doing, what ChatGPT does, go take the corpus of knowledge,
yes,
and then regurgitate it with some context for this application. Like, and man, it just works.
So one thing that AI cannot do is provide cover in the same way to corporations who want to cut staff, but not have it be their idea. That's what I think the real job market is for the McKinseys and the Boston Consulting Groups is you pay them $4 million. They come in and they say, you need to fire half your staff. And then you go, oh, guys, we got to do some layoff. McKinsey told us to. It's not like we invented that and then hired them to tell us what we knew. That's what I think that their real model is. And that would be hard to take away. But anything that was lower level is just going to get consumed because you don't need to pay a human to do it anymore. And frankly, I wonder what that's going to do to us in 50 years. But, you know, graphing calculators came out. People still learn geometry. So it's probably going to be okay.
Gonna be okay.
JKL, let's do Twist 500. I have so much for you. So you sent a call.
Excellent.
You said, everybody in the community, hit us with your favorite construction and housing startups. And holy crap, did people write in dozens and dozens and dozens of companies. And I have put them into two main buckets. There's the, we're a startup that's going to help you build things. And then there are the startups that are working on software and marketplaces for the construction tech world. So in the building things group, there are companies working on ADUs or additional dwelling units, companies like Cover, Housable, Zomes, and Samara. Then there's prefab construction, build it offsite, bring it on, install it. Companies like Boxable, Plant, Prefab, and Zenny. Then a lot of 3D printing startups working with concrete, names like Mighty Buildings, Asher Printed Homes, and Icon. And then my favorite group, robotic construction. Talked about robots the other week. There's really cool companies like Dusty Robotics, QB, Monumental, Agoras, Advanced Construction Robots, and Paint Jet. We'll have videos of a couple of those in just a second. And then, keeping my monologue alive, the software group. These I broke down into digital design software, often with a collaborative twist. Companies like Outgrade, Rayon, Snaptrude, and Palazzo AI. Then there's marketplaces for goods and services, Kojo, Buildstock, visual note-taking, and essentially bringing images of the worksite to your computer, open space company Cam. And then finally, a lot of vertical SaaS for construction, Built Technologies, HiArc, Proppy, Dataform Lab, Permitflow, Hammer, Shepherd, Fieldwire, Buildingswell, and more. The thing that hit me was how many companies are tackling a big chunk or a smaller chunk of this market. I did not know that there are this many companies that have raised $5, $10, $50 million that are working here. Did you know that there were this many companies?
Okay. Yeah, we had an investment in a company called Blockable, and they've had a bit of a tough time because when you actually have to get it, and there was Kaltura, which SoftBank dropped like $1 billion on, and they had like 50 different businesses they were pursuing, and the management was a bit of a disaster, I'm told, on the back channel. And so it's such a big prize. It's so complex that when you go and you do the problem set, the problems to be solved in construction are never ending. Everything can be improved.
Yep.
So everything from the HVAC system, right? And the electronics in the house, that in and of itself is a startup. Then there's, I want to build a home. Okay. Do you want to build a small home, a big home, multifamily? So you have such a range of use cases for construction. And then, you know, if you've ever built a home or you've been involved in a project, there are all these phases and there's all these different vendors that are involved. So managing the process is software and all of that can be improved. So how the architects and the general contractor and the subcontractors all work, well, you take that process and then you take every new technology that comes out and then you make a grid. And I've done this before as an exercise.
Yeah.
And then each box should get filled in some way. So what are three recent trends, horizontal trends in technology? What are the last three or four that are interesting?
The horizontal trends, I would say, is a movement of, well, define horizontal in this context
for you. AI is a horizontal, cloud computing.
Okay.
So like a new technology that's come out that affects everything. So AI, I'll give you that one. Cloud computing is over. But so we have AI as one. So now you take AI.
Okay.
What's another one? Apple released a new product recently.
Well, the Vision Pro, but I don't think that's actually going to pull off. Okay, so fine. AR, VR. There you go.
AR, VR. Okay, so you get AR, VR. You have crypto.
I was about to say blockchain, but I didn't want you to shout at me. So I was going to.
No, you do. I mean, it is a horizontal technology that you could apply to everything, and you have blockchain. Absolutely.
Yes.
So we had a startup that we invested in that's taking homes and allowing people to sell shares in a home and putting it on the blockchain. And then you could buy tokens that represent shares in a home. And that's a way for you to kind of do a reverse mortgage or for a home to be owned by many people. You take AR, VR. We have a company, I believe it's Argyle, that takes your, you put goggles on, you walk around a construction site with the general contractor, with the owners, with a potential buyer of this apartment or this unit, and they get to see it. And then the person who's doing the construction can look down and it says, here's where you put the electrical trowel here, and this is where each screw goes. And they're seeing where the screw goes, and then they put their screw gun on and go, boop. Like, whoa. So you can take any new horizontal technology once you know the problem set and say, well, how does AI impact the construction of homes? Well, I don't know, but maybe it's an AI robot. Then you take robotics, robotic bricklayer. Then you take 3D printing. Okay. 3D printing can do, well, can you make plastics? Can you make walls? What can you make with 3D printing? And, you know, then the challenge becomes it's a slow incumbent industry that's resistant to change. That's the problem.
Well, so, and it also and depends the opportunity. On, it also depends on a lot of folks who swing a hammer for a living. So bringing technology solutions to people who are working with their hands is difficult. I mean, we have ruggedized tablets, we have AR, VR, but like it's going to take a while to go ahead and move this industry forward. Now, I have a couple of videos to show off what we're talking about here, because I know you love some videos. So here is a clip from a company called Cover that I want to put on the Twist 500 because I think they're awesome. They're working in the backyard ADU space, and we're going to kick that off right now.
Okay. Here we go. in a factory.
And this is what they build. So this is a backyard ADU, additional dwelling unit, I believe.
Nanny
and this
unit.
A teaser
what from they the call in-law unit, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But separate. So not inside the same house, somewhere else. Yeah. And what they're doing is building stuff at a factory, as you can see, bringing it out to the site and putting it together quickly. I love cheap, fast, and roomy are my things for housing, because I think everyone should have space at a low cost. Love cover. They have raised a good amount of money. They have put together a total of $73 million so far. Let's move on to the next one here. Icon. 3D printing for homes. Now, you can see this robot in action here. And Jacob, I believe it is doing layers of concrete sequentially in a shape. And it's just awesome, because, you know, once that dries, it is immovable. So
and this company... Those are fascinating to me, because they're just taking what people were using at home with 3D and just saying, well, we can build a honeycomb here, we can build a wall. Of course, you know, the question is the cost of those materials versus doing the studs and the beams. And then, do you want to live in a concrete mausoleum? You know, so there, you know, that's going to be the rub with Icon, I think. But I do think... you can build pretty quickly. And then, so now you have a really nice competition.
Mm-hmm.
Building in a factory with new materials, new science, and then driving it from the factory and using a crane to put it in your backyard.
Yes.
Or setting up a giant 3D printer and you live in a stone adobe mausoleum prison cell. Like, you know, and which one's cheaper and faster? And, you know, in some, there might be some climates or some places where the stone one's much better. I would think if you were in Florida, and I don't know about heat and stone, but you know, you build one of those concrete things and it's two stories, and the first story has a pass through where when it floods, it just goes underneath it. So a lot of the homes in Florida and the bayou and a lot of those places that are being impacted by rising sea levels, the first floor, you park your cars under it, Alex.
Yeah.
And there's no first floor and there's no basement, obviously. You just drive your cars or you store your surfboards or whatever under the house. When the eventual flood happens, no problem. You're just on your porch during the zombie apocalypse and the water's flowing under it. The zombies are walking around. You're up one story and you have like a lot of stairways up to your house. So I do think these things are going to have great applications. They're going to face regulations. And that's one of the great things. The reason why these ADUs are working now, and Blockable was a bit early and some of the other startups were a little bit too early.
Yeah.
Timing so much of this business. The reason was they were, you'd be up against NIMBYism. You want to put an extra unit in your backyard.
Yeah.
Can you rent it? Can you rent it? Oh, you're renting it? Oh, it's an ADU? Okay, so you're renting it for $1,000. Oh, so you're renting it to those people? Those people?
Yeah.
And those people are poor people.
Or anyone who's mindset. Even one socioeconomic class lower.
Yes. Those people are below me.
Right.
Those people were me 10 years ago. I don't want them anywhere near me.
Yes.
And it's like, those are the people who are changing your kids' diapers or like cleaning your garden or teaching your kids at school or the firefighter who comes to your house and puts out the fire. Like, the NIMBYism, and I'll never understand.
Understand it either. And I'm not even from a city. I mean, you're a Brooklyn kid. I'm from rural Oregon, and I don't get it. Like, I grew up with cows, literally, like, if you walk down our backyard to the wire fence, the other side was cows. And I understand, though, that if I want to live in a society that has a working high street, as they say in the
society.
UK, then there's going to be other people around me, and they need a place to live. And you know how San Francisco radicalized me? San Francisco radicalized me against NIMBYs. Like like watching anyone try to build in San Francisco. I remember there was this one time there was a laundromat.
Decades.
No, is it? Well, yes, but the reasons why are hilarious. There was a historically important laundromat. And I'm like, I've been there. It's not. It's a laundromat. Tear it down.
Ginsburg. Wrote poetry in this laundromat while he was cleaning his dirty shorts.
Okay,
great.
You know what? Put a plaque on the first floor of the new 40-story building because cities are for people. They're not living museums. Now, I want to go back though to your mausoleum comment and just run some defense here for concrete buildings. I don't know anything about temperature control or airflow control, but I will say this. I will live in the concrete mausoleum because it looks awesome. And I want to be able to say my house is printed. That just, as a nerd, that just really sits well with me. But we have a place in New Orleans. So I've seen a lot of the different construction styles down there about how to handle flooding. It's going to be a different world in a lot of places. Yep. Let's keep moving though.
Sure.
Court, I want you to grab me the Dusty Robotics video. This one is fantastic, Jason. What is this adorable little guy? This is a robot. Looks like a Roomba if you're not watching the video. And it goes around a concrete floor and prints out the floor plan for studs, for screws, and for all the other things that humans have to do with chalk lines or, you know, with rulers, essentially. This is the coolest thing. And when I was just prepping for the show today, I was entranced by how adorable this thing is. Great.
Well, so here you go. There's a concept here of finding a really acute problem. I think Paul Graham calls it hair on fire problem. Some people call it a painkiller, you know, like you sprained your ankle. You need something now to turn off that pain. This is like one of those perfect examples. You also can call this a wedge strategy. Somebody looked at, or somebody was in construction and they said, you know, it'd be great if robots could build the entire building. And they're like, yeah, robots can't do that yet. And it's like, okay, it'd be great if they could build the walls. And like, I can't do that yet. And I guess with the 3D robot, they can. And they said, well, tell me what takes a lot of time. And the person's like down on their hands and knees with that color chalk, with the things. And they're like, I don't know. And like, well, how long does what you're doing take? And they're like, oh, this is the worst. It takes 10 hours. It takes you 10 hours? Like, oh no, it takes us 10 hours per floor, per room, whatever. Yeah. And they're like, Roomba. I got a Roomba at home. What if a Roomba did it? And it would be more accurate. So this is more accurate, cheaper, better. It's perfect application. So that's the timing I was talking about. When you're doing a startup, you really have to be able to do something 10 times better than it's currently being done to get what's called product market fit and to get market pull. So the strongest aspect of product market fit is market pull, which means people are calling you on the phone and they're like, I need that. I heard you got that. I need you to bring it over right now. Here's my credit card. I'm sending a messenger over with a check. I need that. And you think about in your life, like how many times that's happened? Very rare. But when you see something like this, and if somebody's building a construction site and they, you know, the person who puts those chalk lines down isn't available and this is available, you could see people being like, I need that over here today. Can you get me a couple of those? How do I get those? Like any other groundbreaking product, the market would pull this one. And that's really the high art of being an entrepreneur. If something is so obvious, then the solution is out there already. But if the timing is right with technology, 10 years ago, robots wouldn't have been able to do this pretty well, and it would have been expensive. No. Now, Roombas, you know, there's 100 million Roombas and other similar products that have been made. So when you go to the factory in Shenzhen and you describe that product, they're probably 90% of the way there in terms of your product design. The wheels, the computer vision, you know, the depth and it knowing with the sensors where it is and the depth and the being able to create a virtual map, all that software has been built already. It's been around for a long time. So when you make the lawnmower version of Roomba, you're kind of standing on those shoulders. And the Roomba is standing on the shoulders of all the sensors inside of mobile phones, back to the mobile phone revolution. Boom.
Yeah. I mean, and what that mobile phone point means is people can use these robots from Dusty Robotics anywhere in the world eventually because you'll be able to put the software onto your phone and then make it work. Because we're talking so much about Dusty, let's give them a couple of points here. According to Crunchbase, their last fundraise was a Series B of 2022, $45 million, 250 post, and money from scale venture partners Root, Cantos, Canaan, and Baseline. So there's one to watch.
Great investment.
There's another company that I did not put into this list because I couldn't find a great video to share on the podcast today. But Advanced Construction Robots is doing concrete rebar tying. Have you ever done this?
I have not, but rebar is gnarly, and concrete rebar tiling is hard.
So what you do is, if you don't know, you rebar crosses each other. And what you need to do is take metal wire and wrap it around them and then twist it off so it's tight. That way the rebar stays rigid in a shape so you can pour concrete around it. And what this does to your hands is cut them up into confetti. And you end up with just as you said, gnarly messed up hands and arms. And so when you're talking about like, you know, 10x better,
yeah,
that case, 1x. Mm. As long as it's just not us doing it, it's going to be a hit. But it's so exciting, Jason, to see the number of companies building awesome things to build more houses, because it gives me optimism that the housing crisis in the UK and in the US and in Canada, that we might actually be able to rectify that and make a profit while we're doing it. So it's a win-win. And I love having a little hope. Makes me happy. You
know, and I also saw a robot that was doing, and I don't know if it's a startup or not, or it was a proof of concept, but there was a brick laying robot. And that to me was also very interesting, because you think about backbreaking work, and it's not like bricks are going away. Bricks are like part of society. You clear a field and you dig something, you have all this clay, you got to do something with that moved earth, you start making bricks. So the making of bricks is mm-hmm. something that could be done by a startup, and the laying of bricks could certainly be done by a startup. And, you know, I wonder if the laying of bricks or the 3D model, which one of those would be more cost efficient eventually? Oh, here it is.
Yeah, this is a Dutch company called Monumental, and it's on our list that we're going to add to the Twist 500. Robots that bring bricks, robots that place bricks, and I've done rebar tying, and I've also done bricklaying. And let me tell you, it's really hard to do well. So if there's a robot that can do this, I'm totally into it. And you know what's cool about this, Jason? It's not fast, but it works, as you said the other day, 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
And you can get so much done. And I want more people to have more space and more safety and more security and more just home. So this has been a really fun set of companies to add to Twist 500.
Yeah, because fantastic. Go to twist500.com. We're building this with our friends at Coda. They're not the sponsor of it. We just picked the best tool for the job. Coda is a really great tool for this kind of job. They have sponsored the program before. So just shout out to Coda. I really just love your product to the team over there.
We just met with them, actually.
You did?
Yeah, Bianca and I met with them yesterday. And if you now go to twist500.com, one, the www should be fixed. And two,
resolve domains.
Look,
I love getting down the punch list and doing the bug fixes. Yeah, it's great.
It's that should be fixed now. If it's a problem, email me.
Good. Okay.
But also we learned a lot about how to use Coda in a public setting. So now there's a lot better sorting groups and so forth. And if you give us another 2 days of everyone's patience as we put our learnings into effect, it's going to get super duper cool. I think it's going to be awesome as a tool, and also just as a web property to go and visit. So,
well, you know, I just want to build on your ideas here, you know, in this collaboration that you and I have been doing for a month now. And I really appreciate you coming here and doing the show with me, because it's made it really enjoyable for me. So thank you. A heartfelt thanks, because I look forward to our time here together. I wonder if it would be fun for you and I to take, you know, when we get these lists and we kind of build up our knowledge of them, we could do like a little series here. You know, where we say, hey, you know, you and I fell in love with construction, or you fell in love with construction.
Sure.
We get the producers going. We say, you know what, let's bring 10 of them to New York, LA, San Francisco, or Austin, you know, whatever great city. And we just do a Twist Live with those members of the Twist 500. And we just invite them. It doesn't need to be like a money-making thing. Just be like intellectually curious for us to say to those members, hey, there's 50 of you in construction. We have this theater. You know, or our friends at Microsoft or Google or, you know, Dell or Oracle, they always, you know, they're very kind to us and will give us their conference space. We say, hey, can we use your conference space? We got 200 seats. And we just have those 50 companies over 2 days present what they're working on, the latest, take a couple of questions. It could be like a really fun thing to do based on this research we're doing.
Yeah.
And then I'm building on that. I've been thinking about what we're actually building is like a mutual fund index, right? In some ways. And so I was wondering if, you know, as we get good at this, if we said, I wonder if we could acquire shares let's say we do the construction and we say there's 50 companies here.
Yeah.
And we think these are the 10 best of the 50. We're going to raise a fund to acquire shares in the research we've done and what we think the 10 best privates are. So we're setting up a $20 million vehicle.
Yeah.
To go buy secondary in these specific companies. And so if you own shares in these companies and you're looking to sell them, we got the process going here. Could be like very interesting. I think all this work we're doing for you and I to understand the ecosystem better and not do all companies like you did at Mattermark. Shout out to Mattermark. Who was the founder of Mattermark?
Danielle Morrill.
She was so great.
I love D. She's fantastic.
D was awesome. What a great idea for a company. It didn't work out. It was Crunchbase before Crunchbase. And PitchBook, you know, those being comprehensive is noble and awesome, but skimming the cream, you know, in terms of investing and understanding deeply the dynamics of what makes companies work is going to be a really great partnership for you and I. So those are the two things I've been thinking about. So I don't want to turn all my cards over, but obviously. No,
don't worry. Turn the cards over. I'm taking notes as we go through here. By the way, if you're curious what it's like to work for Jason, it's a lot of that, by the way. Like, you're just hanging out and he's like, oh, by the way, what I want to do is set up a series of SPVs. I want to do a global tour with Google's theaters. Alex, you can put that together, right? Good. All right. So, and you know what? We get a lot done. I'm not going to lie.
Here's the thing. If you hire great people, who are, you know, GSD people, and who are just positive, you know, you can get a lot done if, you know, you get rid of the, what I call the Eeyores, you know, that it can't be done people. When I even just brought up the concept, hey, I wanted this like Twist 500 thing. I just, for my own intellectual curiosity, I'm having a hard time keeping in my brain, what are the most important companies?
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody was like, okay, great. I'm like, let's make it into a database. Use Coda. Works for that. Boom. And the amount of time people spend debating and discussing things, I find sometimes is greater than testing things.
Yeah. I think you just you have to be willing to be 5% more vulnerable than I think most companies want to be. Because like, you know, right now, if you go to twist500.com, I'll confess this, there's an erroneous entry entitled Alex, listed as a unicorn, that we were doing as a test case when we were learning something that I forgot to delete afterwards. So you have to be willing to have a little mud on your shoes if you're going to do this live.
Sure.
But companies like Beehive are building in public.
Yeah.
And they're sharing as they go. And I, to me, it makes me care so much more about the success, the founders, the team.
Are you using Beehive or are you using Substack right now?
I use Substack for my newsletter because I was already there. But the Twist 500 newsletter is on Beehive. So I use Beehive every day to put that together.
What's your take on it? Because it does seem like they're going faster than Substack now. I just had a very high profile person tell me they're leaving Substack for Beehive. And they were just saying the product velocity at Beehive is really good.
The product velocity at Beehive is good. The people are awesome. And they're very much like, woohoo, newsletters. They have that like high energy, that Zenergy, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have an ad network that I'm very interested in. But I still feel like I'm still in experimentation mode. And just because I'm having a baby in less than 2 months, I'm going to probably not throw extra complexity into my life until...
Switching costs, yeah.
Yeah, get that baby out, alive, fed, and then I'll swap URLs. But Jason, before we go, a couple of things for everyone to remember. First of all, like, subscribe, comment if you're on YouTube or the live streams with us. And the Launch Accelerator cohort number 32 is live. The companies are Chef Reaction, Ellis, LayerPath, MasterTech AI, Rafa with a PH, and then Qerio, Q-U-E-R-I-O. Make sure to take a look at them. Cool companies. I got to take a peek at all of them yesterday for the newsletter.
Excellent. Yeah, we are trying to, one of the efforts we're going to make here is to have what we're doing in the investment company and what we're doing on this podcast just a little bit tighter. Bianca's been doing a great job bridging those two groups. And congratulations to the people in our 32nd cohort. If you don't understand what an accelerator is, it's usually we do 7 people per cohort. We might increase it a little bit because we have so much demand. And we'll give those founders 125K. And we're okay losing it. We're looking to make high-risk bets here. Typically, the companies have a product in market, an MVP. They might have between $3,000 and $50,000 a month in revenue. Over 14 weeks, we introduce them to 500 investors or more.
Mm-hmm.
We help them with their pitch. We help them with product market fit. And then they're all going to spend you know, a little bit of time with me. We're going to do some sort of retreat in Austin Hill Country with some... barbecue and you know, hanging out and some casitas and you know, just co-working together for 3 or 4 days. So I'm super excited about the LA 32 retreat we're planning, which they didn't know, nobody knew about until this moment. So back to your
my blank face was, oh, I wasn't aware of that. We should do some live Twist while we're there.
Absolutely.
We
really like to help these companies get through, you know, the first, what I call year zero, when they're trying to figure out if they even want to do a company. That's Founder University. And then there's Launch Accelerator, which comes with an investment by default. And that's like, you kind of already got a product and, you know, maybe 2, 3, 4 people, just like Y Combinator, just like Techstars. Shout out to the two Davids at Techstars. All right.
All right, everybody. That is the show. We are back next week with more news. Jason and I will never stop, but don't forget, we also have the Twist 500 newsletter, which is well worth your time. And we will have a link to that in the show notes. Jason, thank you. We'll see everyone next week.